It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farrow. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we take a look into the world of ambitious millennials with big ideas in Silicon Valley.
First, Governor Scott Walker is traveling around the state to announce a package of welfare changes. He's calling the program Wisconsin Works for Everyone. The governor was in Milwaukee earlier today to announce one component of the plan to require parents who get food stamps to work at least 80 hours per month.
Chuck Kornbach joins us now. He's a WPR News reporter based in Milwaukee. He was covering the governor's announcement earlier today. Chuck, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
As you understand it, is this part of a bigger attempt to change the welfare system in Wisconsin?
Well, it certainly could be. The governor has been talking about a number of things over the last several months, but this is an item that's going to be in his proposed state budget next month, he says. And again, as you were saying, the main change would be that parents with school-aged children, able-bodied parents who are potentially receiving public benefits, public welfare benefits, would have to work either 80 hours a month or receive job training. Currently, the law mainly pertains to childless adults, but the governor is talking about families.
And talk about the event today. Governor Walker kicked off kind of a tour around the state explaining what he's doing here.
Well, indeed. Milwaukee, Green Bay, Eau Claire, Madison. Now, you mentioned his program is titled Wisconsin Works for Everyone. It's, of course, a play on the W-2 Wisconsin Works legislation in the mid-1990s. In fact, some of the folks who were in the room in Milwaukee or elsewhere today were around in 96 promoting some of these types of items. Governor Walker, State Senator Alberta Darling in Milwaukee, and in Madison, former Governor Tommy Thompson was slated to join Walker. So it did have that sort of 90s feel about it.
And why did Governor Walker say there was a need for this change?
Well, you can say that there are potentially some political benefits for him. He's potentially facing a Republican governor's contest next year, and needs to perhaps boost his favorability ratings and thinks that going after some welfare recipients will do that. But he says, more specifically, that the private sector wants this change, that he says he's hearing from employers across the spectrum.
From healthcare providers to long-term care facilities, from manufacturing to transportation to agriculture to information technology. There's just such a worker shortage here and around the country.
And in his State of the State address, he used the phrase workforce, workforce, workforce as the explanation of his focus for the next couple of years. This, it sounds like, is part of that effort.
Yeah, I mean, he was talking in Milwaukee about the state's unemployment rate being down to 4% or so, that there's a high percentage. Wisconsin has a relatively high percentage of people in the workforce compared to other states. But there are job openings here and there, and he believes they can be filled by some people that may be receiving public benefits now and thinking that they could find a better way to the workforce with a little encouragement.
Talking to Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee, about Governor Walker's program announced today, Wisconsin Works for Everyone, trying to make more people who are receiving public benefits enter the workforce. Parents would be included in this of school-aged children. I don't know if we've gotten to this level of specifics yet, Chuck, but any thoughts on what this would cost?
Well, that's one thing he was asked in Milwaukee anyway, and he said he did not have a budget estimate yet. But he said that even some things that might require some initial expenditures would pay off in the long run if people are in the workforce paying taxes and so on. So that's certainly an item that will get close scrutiny when he puts it in the state budget.
And have we been hearing response, any criticism of this new proposal, again, just made today?
Oh, things are ramping up by the hour, or by the minute, I guess I should say. Midday today, I heard from Ken Taylor of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Now, he cautioned that there may be some things in this he likes, and he certainly wants to see more details in this. But he says there are some parts of the governor's plan that give him pause.
The main pause is that the governor's initial food stamps for work proposal, three people lost their benefits for everyone who got a job. And so we certainly don't want to replicate that dynamic for parents taking care of their kids.
As reaction comes in, Chuck, what other kinds of things are you hearing about this idea for a new program so far?
Well, the Republican governor has drawn a share of criticism from Democrats in the legislature, as the Senate Democratic leader Jen Schilling says, once again, Scott Walker is creating one set of rules for working families, another set of rules for the wealthy and well-connected, meaning that Walker has some goodies proposed, she says, for the wealthy in the state budget or in other legislation. State Senator LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee says she believes it's morally unfair and unjust to threaten reduced access to food. But the governor is getting some support, of course, including from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business group. They're pointing out that part of Walker's proposal talks about eliminating a so-called benefits cliff. In other words, as people gain more money in the workforce, they're less eligible for certain benefits and then maybe don't want to go up in status or rank or salary at work because they worry about losing the benefits. This proposal talks about easing the transition and having, for example, child care, the people only paying about one-third, one of the additional $3 that they would make from a raise, only one-third to go into child care. So there would be some sort of gradual effects to help people into the workforce and not fall off the cliff, so to speak.
Just broad outlines today, Chuck. Do we have an idea of when we'll get more details on this?
Well, I think now that the cat's out of the bag, so to speak, that there will be a variety of groups inquiring about details. The news media has already gotten the governor's office later today to suggest that any benefits cut for the families would not threaten a family, not threaten kids' access to food, but of course that's going to be a debated point. But the other thing is, of course, with Republican lawmakers controlling both houses of the legislature and then Republican governor, I'm not sure how much Democrats will be able to slow this down until. But the thing that they do need to get is some federal approval for some of this, and that could perhaps be problematic if there is a delay in what the Trump administration is willing to approve for the governor. It's probably more likely that Trump would go along as opposed to what President Barack Obama was willing to accept. But it still may take a while to get federal waivers.
Right. The timing of this a few days after a Republican president is inaugurated might suggest that the governor is more hopeful under the new administration that these changes could happen. Briefly, as we wrap up, Chuck.
Right. He's got a former policy aide in Wisconsin who's working for Donald Trump now, who's giving him some encouraging green lights about this potential.
Chuck, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Kornbach, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's new program announced today in a series of events around the state. Wisconsin works for everyone. There's a place in America for young men and women with big ideas where entrepreneurial people hope to get rich and earn fame by opting out of college in the Ivy Leagues, where role models are expected to wear baggy jeans and a t-shirt, not a suit and tie.
The place, the technology hub of Silicon Valley. And our next guest is a reporter who followed the young men and women in Northern California who are taking unconventional roads to become the next Mark Zuckerberg. Alexandra Wolf is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she joins us now to talk about her new book. It's called Valley of the Gods, a Silicon Valley story. Alexandra, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by having you tell us about Peter Thiel's 20 Under 20 program to get kids to what he calls stop out of college.
Yeah, exactly. It was actually a play on Timothy Leary. He had a phrase called it was sort of a hippie phrase that Peter Thiel spun around to be stop out, start up, and so he convinced 20 students under 20 to drop out of college and start companies out in Silicon Valley, and he'd give them $100,000 for 2 years, and they came up with all sorts of outlandish ideas, from mining asteroids to starting funds that would try to extend life forever. So it was pretty interesting to meet them.
And these kids, I mean, they're young people, but apparently they don't seem out of place in Silicon Valley because it sounds like one of the must-haves there is youth. Why is that at such a premium?
Well, it's really funny. It's so different than the East Coast where I grew up. If you go out there, when I went out for the first time, it really looked like it was a big dorm. I mean, the offices have bean bags in them. Everybody has hoodies and jeans and sneakers, and it just the whole look of the place is so different than on the East Coast. And I think also they were similar in that their interests were so unusual. So many of them were really interested in living forever and artificial intelligence and all sorts of new technology that comes to the East Coast a lot later. So the younger the person, the more likely they were going to think of something new, I think, went the thinking. And one founder I knew was in his 40s, except for he tried to eat less because he thought if you looked younger, I mean, if you looked thinner, you would look younger, and so it would be easier to recruit younger people because they would think, oh, I'm working for a really young CEO. So it was pretty funny the lengths that people went to look young out there.
How old are you when you're considered old in Silicon Valley?
Well, I'm 36, and I look like a grandmother out there, I think. I mean, everybody, there are actually, it's kind of a misconception because everybody looks so young, but a lot of the companies at the beginning had an adult in the room. Eric Schmidt was the CEO of Google for a time at the beginning, and he's far older than in his 20s. I believe he's now in his 50s or 60s. And so I think there, the idea with the Thiel Fellowship was to get students before they'd gone to college and learned another way of thinking and were sort of already set on a particular track. So if you got somebody young, they knew all the new code, they were up on everything, the best technology, the best strategies, the best new ideas, and that was sort of the thing they'd get them fresh before they'd been corrupted by corporations or institutions like college.
And he did. You followed three fellows in this first class, and they were studying different things, longevity and sleep and mining asteroids. But
yeah,
can you tell us who these people were with these eclectic interests at such a young age?
They really were interesting. I mean, the one that I followed the most closely, his name is John Burnham, and he was from just outside of Boston, and he was always sort of a misbehaved student in high school. And he read everything well before anybody else. He was so smart. He knew everything about philosophy, everything about asteroids, I guess. And he applied to the fellowship and answered. They asked this one question on the applications, which was, "What do you believe in that nobody else does?" And for most of these kids, they really had a good answer to that. They had really different opinions than most of their peers. They were so far ahead intellectually than most of their peers. And so he had an interesting story because he went out originally trying to mine asteroids, and he realized it was way harder than he thought. And other people who with way bigger budgets had already gone into, I mean, with Elon Musk and SpaceX and Peter Diamandis, the man who created the X Prize, was already looking into these ideas, and he decided that he was going to pivot, a.k.a. fail and completely change his idea, and do this online currency that he would turn gold. He tried to turn gold into something you could pay with gold on your phone, and that didn't work. So then he ended up going back to college, and then in college he came up with a new idea. He posted it on a website called TechCrunch. It got a lot of attention, and then he realized, oh, this has promise. I'm going to go back to Silicon Valley, and he dropped out of college again, and he went back to Silicon Valley. He tried to do this new software company. That failed, and so then he went back to school, and he went to this really small religious liberal arts school called Thomas More, and then he decided to drop out of that school and go back to Dartmouth. So he's had this really up and down road, which a lot of them did because they'd never lived away from home, and suddenly they were bypassing college and trying to make it as adults in Silicon Valley. So it was really interesting to see the world from their point of view.
But it sounds like failure is not something that you hide, that you're ashamed of. It almost sounds like failure is at the top of your calling card in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, you're totally right. That was what everybody said. Failure was seen as such a virtue. And it was up there with words like disrupt, transgress, hack. You know, everything was sort of, they were really interested in hacking anything from morality to gender behavior to everything. I mean, it was so interesting to see how they would push the boundaries like that.
We're talking with Alexander Wolf right now, staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal and the author of the new book called Valley of the Gods, a Silicon Valley story. And Alexander, your book opens with a fancy hotel. That's the scene. And these very young tech, possibly billionaires, probably a lot of wealth there, maybe being picked up by women. And it does seem as though it's run by guys, and the women that you write about, not exclusively, but a lot of them are referred to as the wives. So is Silicon Valley a guy's place?
It really feels like that. It feels like, I think they've made a lot of progress. I think there are a lot more women now in leadership roles. But the scene that you mentioned in the beginning of the book is called Cougar Night, and that is very real. And that is the only place in Silicon Valley where I saw more women than men on a given night. And it was so funny. It was this really high-end hotel on Sand Hill Road where a lot of the venture capital firms are. And every Thursday night, these women would come and they would sort of prey on these young engineers that were populated the area, and it was an unusual ratio to see there. But I do think, I mean, the one woman that I really focused on in the book, this woman, Laura Deming, who is a Thiel Fellow, she actually didn't find it to be that much of a problem because it sort of helped her stand out. I mean, she was one of the few Thiel Fellows that year in 2011. Who was a woman, and a lot of people gravitated to her because she was just so unusual. But I do feel like that's not necessarily the case across the board. I think it is. I think it does need to be addressed. And I think some companies, there are a growing number of venture capital firms that are trying to encourage female investors and the promotion of women. And so I think it has been addressed more than it was when I was first reporting the book out there 5 years ago.
And you also write that the Valley is what you call a laboratory of cultural experimentation, and it does have its own culture. Does that culture, do you think, have the power to leave the coast where it's in this little bit of a bubble and influence the culture in the rest of the country?
Well, I think in some ways it really already has. I heard this funny story about a banker who went out to Silicon Valley to underwrite one of these big tech deals or an IPO, and he's a 75-year-old guy who's used to wearing a suit every single day, and he showed up in a hoodie, and it just looked totally ridiculous. But you sort of see that style all over the rest of the country now. I mean, I took a bus tour just out of curiosity called Startup Bus from New York to Austin, Texas, where they had South by Southwest. And I couldn't believe that we stopped in a number of cities on the way. And the idea was to start companies on the bus. And so it was just part of this whole Silicon Valley mania. But all of the places we stopped had their own entrepreneur centers. I mean, there's an entrepreneur center in Nashville. There's one in San Antonio. There are entrepreneur centers and innovation labs cropping up at universities all over the country. But it does seem difficult to exactly replicate it. Nobody seems to have been able to do that. Maybe Austin would be closest. Seattle has a good long tech history. But it does seem difficult to get it exactly the same.
Well, at the end of the day, it sounds like, you know, there was mixed success, and it's not clear whether this is a place that where dreams are made or where dreams
right.
are broken, and it's a cautionary tale. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I see it that way. And then in a way, it seems indicative of the cycles of Silicon Valley. About 10% of the fellows in this program, the Thiel Fellowship, went back to college. And then a fair amount of them did succeed, a handful, which in terms of proportion, is probably slightly higher than the number of people, the massive amounts of people that go to Silicon Valley to try to start companies and then actually end up being successful. And I guess it also depends on the definition of success. I mean, if you ask the Thiel Foundation, who's behind that whole fellowship that encouraged students to drop out, they would say they were just encouraging them to take a pause and not necessarily make billions of dollars, but to think, oh, maybe I don't have to join this track, or maybe I don't have to become part of this company. Maybe I can pursue what I've always wanted to do. And in a way, I think that impulse is quite admirable. I think the idea of everybody becoming an entrepreneur is probably overrated, but the idea of being entrepreneurial and being self-starting and self-motivated and come up with something new, it seems like quite a good impulse to have. I'm not as enthusiastic about the everybody fail because it's really not that fun to fail. I mean, as you know, all of us have failed at some point, and it's not that enjoyable. I guess it's a learning experience, but to have it be so glorified seems like could be a mistake.
And Alexander, before I let you go, I mean, based on what you saw there, is the prevailing ethos of Silicon Valley is it about making new stuff and changing the world, or is it about making billions of dollars?
I bet. I mean, to be completely honest, it felt like at the end of the day, the motive was more to make billions of dollars. But if you're going to have a pretension or an affectation around your motive, I kind of prefer the one that is, oh, I'm going to change the world, versus the one that is, how high can my number get? There's something sort of optimistic about the idea of, oh, I'm going to change the world. There, it's such a cliche. If you say, oh, I built this company to change the world, it seems like people roll their eyes in a way. But to the rest of the country and to me, I felt like it was at least a good starting point to think, oh, I'm going to move to Silicon Valley to change the world. It can be seen as a little bit megalomaniacal, but a lot of these companies actually have in really valuable ways. I mean, think of Uber and Airbnb. They've completely changed the world. And so when people go out there and look at the examples, the examples are actually doing that. So I commend the impulse, but then at the same time, I think that a lot of the motive actually is to make money and is to be successful in financially. But as long as the change the world impulse is there, I think it's probably a pretty good thing.
Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Alexandra Wolf. She's a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and she talked to us about her new book called Valley of the Gods, a Silicon Valley story.
The words, I'm sorry, can be seen as the two most powerful words in the English language, but they can also be the toughest to say.
That's according to Harriet Lerner. She's a nationally recognized psychotherapist and relationship expert, known for her work on the psychology of women and family relationships. And she's the author of 12 other books, including The Dance of Anger.
And her new book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. She joins us now. Harriet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
What makes apologies such powerful and sometimes complicated things?
Well, first of all, it's so important. We're all connected. We all screw up. We all unwittingly hurt other people just as we're hurt by them. So the need to give and receive apologies is with us until our very last breath. And if done well, the apology is deeply healing. And if the apology is absent or we muck it up, it actually can put a crack in the very foundation of the relationship or even end it. So it's a really important topic, and it's very important to get it right. It's very easy to get it wrong.
Let's get into how to make a bad apology, because you spent some time on that in the book. What are some of the ways that we faux apologize, that we say things that sound like an apology but really don't convey that message sincerely?
The most common way is with the word but. I'm sorry I yelled at you, but you provoked me. I'm sorry I forgot to call you on your birthday, but I was totally snowed under with work. It doesn't matter if what you say after the but is true. The but makes the apology false. It always indicates some kind of excuse or rationalization. So the first thing would be to get your but out of your apology, and no pun intended. And then the second most common way is when we apologize for the other person's feelings and reactions, rather than apologizing directly for what we said or did or didn't say or do. For example, I'm sorry that you were upset that I corrected your stories at the party. That is not an apology. There's no accountability there. So a real apology would be, I'm sorry I corrected your stories at the party. You've told me that you don't like that. I was totally wrong, and I won't do it again. And the list goes on.
You give a lot of examples throughout the book, anecdotes from people you know, yourself and others. One common thing that seems to come up a lot is that often in an interaction gone wrong between two people, there's some offense on both sides, some harm caused by both parties and received by both parties. And it seems like that is one of the toughest situations to sort out an apology, because we might have the sense of justice. Well, if I'm going to apologize, maybe they should apologize, too.
Exactly. For example, in my marriage to Steve, I like to apologize for exactly my part of the problem, as I calculated, of course, which is never more than 47%. And I expect Steve to apologize for his part of the problem exactly as I calculate it. And we often don't do the same math. And that is simply one very common apology problem, where each person wants the other to apologize first because they're vying for the position of the one who's more to, you know, who's more to blame, who started it. And it really does take a lot of maturity to care enough about the relationship to be the first to accept responsibility for our part of the problem, without a hint of evasion, excuse making, or blaming, even when the other person can't do the same.
Or even maybe you make your end of the apology in a magnanimous spirit and then eagerly leave the table open for them to take their turn. And maybe they do or maybe they don't.
Right, exactly. Maybe they do or maybe they don't. But, you know, we always stand on higher ground when we are able to be our best selves and not just act in reaction to the other person's immaturity.
Talking to Harriet Lerner, author of the new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Talking about the power of saying I'm sorry and some of the roadblocks to doing it. I want to talk about a couple of extreme cases, Harriet. First of all, the person who never apologizes, who never admits culpability, wrongdoing to anyone. Often you write the person who does the most harm to begin with. How, if we're the person on the receiving end of that person's treatment, how can we approach that?
Well, first of all, most of us can apologize, and we have trouble in particular situations. For example, many people have trouble apologizing in a relationship where they feel overly criticized. There are too many criticisms and little corrections, and it's hard then to apologize when we should in that kind of situation. But we'll apologize with other people and in other situations. The entrenched non-apologizer is a person who walks on a tightrope of defensiveness above a huge canyon of low self-esteem. In order to apologize for a really serious hurt, we need to stand on a great big solid foundation of self-worth. And from that higher vantage point, we can look out at our mistakes and apologize, because we can see our mistakes as part of a much bigger, more complex, ever-changing picture of who we are as a human being. But people who do serious harm stand on a small, rickety platform of self-worth, and they're unable to get it. They're unable to see the harm they've done, because to do so would threaten them to collapse into an identity of worthlessness or shame. And no one can tolerate that. So it's very important for those people who want to confront a serious harm, say with a parent or a family member, to understand that the response you get has nothing to do with how much that person loves you. What it has to do with is the amount of self-worth that that person has to draw upon. So it's important to understand, if you're opening up a conversation with someone who's going to wrap themselves in defensiveness and minimization and denial, that if you're going to speak because you need to hear the sound of your own voice saying what you know to be true. Because the apology that you're longing for may not be coming, you know, not now or not ever.
We're talking to psychotherapist Harriet Lerner. Her newest book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts.
And we want to hear from you. What's important to you when you're getting an apology? Do you have trouble bringing yourself to say I'm sorry? And do you have a method of apologizing that's worked well for you? Has a meaningful apology helped maybe repair a relationship in your life? You can tell us about it at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the value of a good apology with Harriet Lerner. She's a nationally recognized psychotherapist, and her newest book is called Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes for a good and effective apology, and a bad one for that matter? Do you have a way that you have apologized in the past? Has a relationship in your life been saved by a good apology from you to someone else, or vice versa? Do you feel the need to say sorry to someone in your life? You're struggling to find the right words. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Harriet, we've talked some about what makes a bad apology. People have come to you asking the question, I've had a rift in a relationship in my life. I know it's at least partly my own fault. What do you tell them about how to make that step and make a good, solid, effective apology?
Well, I probably wouldn't give them instructions, but I would certainly be very interested in their capacity to really listen to the hurt or angry party that they want to apologize for. That's really the hardest part. You know, we're wired for defensiveness. And what the hurt party really wants to hear is not just the words, I'm sorry, which, by the way, can be a quick way out of the conversation. Like, I told you 5 times I was sorry about the affair. Why do you keep bringing it up? What the hurt party really needs, if we're going to give a healing, heartfelt apology, is they need us to listen. That we need to say, yes, I get it. Your feelings make sense. I screwed up. I want you to know that this is not going to happen again. But that doesn't have meaning if we haven't really listened. So maybe the most important thing I would want such a person to know is what I just said, that no apology will have meaning if we haven't listened carefully to the hurt party's anger and pain, which is so difficult to do because we're wired for defensiveness.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Sharon on the line in Walworth. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Sharon?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually a first-time caller. I have a question. I have an 11-year-old son. I just recently divorced. I have 3 little ones. I have 11, 9, and 7. I also have an older one, but he's not a part of the divorce. Anyway, my 11-year-old, he's very passive and accommodating, but he constantly is apologizing for everything. If he sees me upset, or if he sees somebody else upset, or just any circumstance, he's always like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I just was wondering, I tell him, I say, son, you don't have to apologize unless you've done something wrong or made a mistake. you know, you don't need to apologize for everything. And I'm constantly trying to reassure him and affirm him and love on him. And, you know, I just was wondering, what do you say about that? I mean, how do I convince him or guide him and direct him and stop apologizing and being so passive and not standing up for himself and just honestly taking the burden for other people's mistakes as well?
Sharon, thanks for the call. And Harriet, I know this is something you might spend time with a client on, talk a patient for a long time, but generally for a young person who's over apologizing, it sounds like, do you have some general words of advice?
I would say, Sharon, to not worry about it. And, of course, post-divorce and post-divorce lasts a long time. You know, a lot of behaviors of children are going to be very exaggerated. And it sounds like you have done a very good job letting him know, you know, that he really doesn't need to apologize for something unless he really has done something that he thinks is wrong. And since you've told him that, and you've told him with clarity, I would defocus on it. I would not be concerned about his behaviors. I would stop correcting him about the over-apologizing. Because sometimes the more we focus on a child's behavior that we believe is problematic, it actually will exacerbate the behavior. So I wouldn't worry about it. And what I would try to do is to keep the lines of communication open around the issues of the divorce. You know, what's the hardest thing for him about the divorce? And to be very clear with him, and of course all the kids, that he's not responsible for anything about the divorce, that he didn't cause it, he can't fix it, that his job is to have the best relationship with you and his dad that he can have, because it's possible that the over-apologizing relates to, you know, kids often unconsciously feel responsible for everything that occurs in the family. So I wouldn't worry about this. I just wouldn't worry about it, Sharon.
Sharon, good luck to you and your family, and thanks so much for making that first call. We'll go next to Rob on the line in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Rob?
Well, I'm a part-time chaplain, and a lot of what I do is I deal with people who either themselves or their families have to come to a point of forgiveness as the person is reaching the end of life. And I've found that there could be kind of a paradox between apology and forgiveness in that, in order to achieve the latter, the former can be either a great first step or it can be a meddling factor. And, you know, I guess I would like to, if there's a way that I can professionally avoid the meddlesome apology to achieve forgiveness, I'd like to be able to do that. Does your guest have any advice for achieving forgiveness with or without apology?
Harriet, any thoughts?
Well, in my book, Why Won't You Apologize, Rob, I have a chapter called You Need to Forgive and Other Lies That Hurt You, because there are many routes to finding peace of mind without forgiveness. And I think that when people believe that there can be no peace or healing without forgiveness, and this is the only path to a life not mired down in bitterness or hate, it leads to problems. Forgiveness is not always a cheap gift. For some people, it has to be earned. And a colleague of mine, Janice Abrams Spring, has written a good book about forgiveness that I like. And one of the points she makes is that you don't necessarily restore your humanity when you forgive a non-apologetic offender. He restores his humanity when he works to earn your forgiveness. So
So I don't mean to sound like a big meanie, Rob. I have nothing against forgiveness. But when forgiveness is touted as the only path to healing, when people are told that they're a less loving and whole person if there are certain things they do not forgive, I see that as problematic. So I'm actually very interested in the forgiveness issue. And if you read my chapters, I would be very interested in hearing, because you are a chaplain, I'd be very interested in hearing your reaction.
Rob, thanks for that call. We're talking to Harriet Lerner about her new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Time for another caller. Terry is on the line in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I wanted to chime in. I am a single parent of two teenage daughters, and occasionally, through providing guidance and discipline to both of my daughters, occasionally I will slip up and maybe say something that I realize momentarily later that, or moments later, that I may have said the wrong thing and hurt their feelings. And it might be easy for some people to do that and to walk away and not be concerned about the child's feelings. I find myself realizing that I have to quickly react to that error and apologize or reframe the comment that I made, which might have been hurtful. So that's my advice. If there are any parents out there, for me, this has been something that I realize is the right way to go.
Terry, thanks for the call. Harriet, we're just about out of time. But thoughts on making that apology sooner rather than later?
It actually does not matter very often. I work with parents who have said to their adult children, you know, I've been thinking about some things that happened 10 years ago around the time of, you know, the divorce. And I actually have been thinking that I was not very available to you at the time of the divorce. And I'm wondering what that was like for you, because I actually think about that all the time. In other words, it is never too late to open up a conversation and apologize to a family member for something that might have happened decades ago.
We'll leave it there. Harriet, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking to Harriet Lerner. She's a psychotherapist, a relationship expert. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. If you go over to the Central Time Facebook page, you can find a link to some information about her book. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts on apologies. What makes a good apology? What makes a bad apology? And is there a time in your life where an apology made a difference, helped patch over some problems, or would have made a difference? Is there somebody you still maybe think you ought to make that apology to? Again, find more info, share your thoughts, maybe your experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page.
On this day in 1957, toy history was made with the production of the first Frisbee by the Wham-O Company.
The flying disc concept had been around for a while. In the late 1800s, apparently, college students in Connecticut would throw around pie tins from the Frisbee Baking Company.
And as a warning to passersby, they would yell, Frisbee!
Plastic flying discs came along earlier in the 1950s, but the first ones, the magic came when they put them under the Frisbee name. They hit the production lines 60 years ago today.
And no shock, the Frisbee caught on, and it's an inductee in the National Toy Hall of Fame.
This is one of those brands that might be too effective, you know, like the Xerox and Kleenex thing where people call similar products that aren't that. I mean, if I have, you know, you'll see them labeled flying disc. Oh, that's not official Frisbee
that's not
brand.
As much fun.
But are you going to say throw me the flying disc?
No.
If you have that in the park? No. You're going to say throw me the Frisbee. I used to throw the Frisbee around a lot more with the kids, especially.
Yeah.
Haven't lately.
I'm not super at catching frisbees or throwing frisbees for that matter. So I remember,
but watching them fly,
the kids
got
were little.
Down.
We did get, you know, the giant ones where almost anyone
awesome.
Could catch them. Those, yeah, those were pretty fun.
I don't know if those are frisbee brand though.
I don't
not
know.
to be fussy
good point,
about
good
it.
Point.
Well, this is Central Time bringing you toy news here on the Ideas Network.